Introducing two new Subway melts. Try the new chicken cordon bleu melt stacked with juicy chicken, black forest ham, and melted cheese. Or the new $5 footlong chicken marinara melt. Tender chicken covered in marinara sauce and melted cheese. Melted goodness made irresistible. Subway melts. Subway. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. I had Chuck Klosterman on, author of Eating the Dinosaur. He was on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline, and we went so long, as we so often do, because we have a lot of opinions on a lot of things, and we end up getting into arguments and making each other mad. We had split this into two parts. So here's part two of my conversation with Chuck that was taped on December 16th. The MTV generation, and when MTV started in the video era and all that, the bands that were like in the 5-year stretch that peaked like right before MTV came out and kind of missed that wave of becoming popular on video. Mm-hmm. It's a little like the Shooters that were great shooters right before the 3-point line.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like Rick Barry, if he had a 3-point line his whole career, his career is different than it was pre 3-point line. There's guys like that, or Dave the Busher. And so what bands do you think from, I'm going to say, 76 to 81 have a totally different career if they come along 5 years later?
Well, okay, this is kind of a complex answer, but something very specific happened to those bands at the end of the 70s, which is that there was a new sort of thinking in FM radio. The thinking in FM radio became, the main thing we want is people not to change the station, because we're making so much money with ads now. We really see a lot of money can be made with commercial advertising. The key is sort of to keep somebody feeling like they're hearing one long song. And that really ushered in this period of faceless rock bands like Foreigner or Speedwagon, Styx. These bands would put, like Boston would put a spaceship on the cover of the record. You couldn't even see the band. Foreigner put the number 4 on a record, just the number 4, you know. And they were, all these records recorded in exactly the same way, and the songwriting was very similar. And the idea was basically to create one sound, which was like late 70s FM radio sound. And as a consequence, radio was really successful, and those bands sold many, many records because people were buying them almost interchangeably. So then when MTV became a real big element, they were not really well positioned to be visual bands. And they'd also put a lot of emphasis on the virtuosity and musicality of their performance, which is why when you see an early Journey video, or like you see an early REO Speedwagon video, they make a big point in it having a few scenes where you see them playing their instruments. Because there was this fear in the early 80s that people were going to see videos on MTV and think that all of these bands were sort of constructed by some Bengali or something.
I think you just described the thinking behind the Separate Ways video.
That's a great example of it, where they're almost trying to make a point that, see, we're playing imaginary keyboards here.
Yeah.
But if there was a keyboard here, we would be playing it.
Yeah. Well, that is just about the greatest answer I think you've ever given on this podcast. I think you're totally right. I agree 100%, and I have nothing to add. We have to do this because this is one of the reasons I brought you on. So Rolling Stone, they come out, it's the end of the decade.
Okay. And
they come out with the decade in music, which is one of those things that you never think about until the end of the decade, and then you're like, all right, wait a second. What happened this decade? Where did we start, and where did we end up, and what were the forces and all that stuff? And so, it's Rolling Stone. I actually really like Rolling Stone. I always get one or two things, but musically they can tend to skew a little bit older. And Jan Wenner, you never know how much influence he has in the rankings. And I open it up.
He has a ton of influence. He doesn't know
anything.
So that's why their rankings are useless.
Well,
He's so, completely sycophantic. He puts Bruce Springsteen at 15 and 24. You think the Bruce Springsteen record Magic was the 24th best record that came out last decade? That's insane.
He put the 2009 U2 album also made it, but we'll get to that. But so I open
that
this up.
Not terrible. It's not the 13th best record, but I mean, at least it was competitive when it came out. You know?
It's well, the 2000 U2 album was 13th. I was okay with that. But anyway, so I open this up and I'm like, they're going to screw over the Strokes. I'm going to get really mad. These things make me mad. I don't know why. I wish I didn't get mad. I wish this didn't make me want to call three of my friends and argue about this immediately. But the Strokes are going to get the shaft here because this is Rolling Stone and Jan Wenner made the rankings and U2's. Every U2 album will be in the top 10. And much to my surprise, the Strokes were second.
Well, the top of that Rolling Stone list wasn't bad. I think the two game-changing records of the decade, if you had to put, like, which records had the sort of the most impact, it would be the College Dropout and Kid A. And I think Kid A was one, and Kanye was 10. The Strokes were two. I actually would have put the Strokes one because I just think that if somebody makes a movie about, say, what life in America was like post-9/11 or pre-9/11 on either side of that equation, the music you would use is the Strokes if you were doing it in the future. I mean, to me, that's what the sound of those records, you know, that record was supposed to come out, I believe, on September 18th. I think it was the Tuesday after September 11th.
Yep.
And I remember even at the time thinking, like, I wonder if this is – because I had – like, you have the – do you have the U.S. version of the Strokes record or the British version?
I have no
idea.
What's
on the cover of the CD? Does it have the song New York City Cops on it?
The cover of the CD went about 8 years ago when I moved to albums for all my CDs. Go ahead.
On the British version of that record, there's a song called New York City Cops. It might be the strongest song on that record. And that, of course, was removed when it came out on following 9/11 because you couldn't make jokes about cops or whatever. But
I don't have that record. I have the American then.
Yeah. The guy, the publicist for the Strokes, I can't remember what his name was, he did a really smart thing. It's like the first time and the last time this has ever worked. Long before that record came out, he sent cassettes of the Strokes material to like every rock critic around and said, hey, I don't usually do this, but I think these guys might be okay. I'm just not sure. You don't got to write about this. Just tell me what you think of this. So they all listened to these early Strokes songs, and everybody was like, these guys are great, and they seemed really New York, and they seemed sort of – it was during this period like when, I don't know, like the cocaine climate had changed New York, so cocaine was suddenly a really kind of normative thing, and people were dressing in this way that was Strokes-like, and you would talk to people about having Strokes hair. You saw a lot of guys with Strokes hair. They all, you know, and it just seemed like that music and that sort of style and posture really kind of defined the early part of that decade in a way that no other music did later.
Yeah, and as I emailed you, you know, for me, I remember getting that album and being in my car and listening to it for the first time. And it was, as you said, I don't think I got it the week after 9/11, but it was within a couple weeks. And it was just like, it was coming out of this like 3-4 year abyss of bad music, where music was just sucked. I hated it. And I know my tastes are specific and not everybody has the same musical taste, but what was happening in the kind of music that I had liked and that, you know, I loved in college and after college, it was just gone. And it was this Limp Bizkit and Britney and just was awful. And then I heard this album and I was like, oh my God, like here it comes. And then the White Stripes also, and then all of a sudden things were good again.
White Stripes had predated them a little bit, but they did
Elephant
around the same time.
Yeah, but then, for them, it was the 2003 that was... Yeah, I thought that was their masterpiece. But that got number five.
No, Elephant got number five.
That's what I'm talking about, Elephant.
Oh, I thought you were talking about White Blood Cells.
No. I liked White Blood Cells.
Elephant probably is their best record. I guess I like Distill the most, but that was the first record of theirs I really liked a lot, so that probably has some impact. It's interesting, though, when you listen to the White Stripes over time now, when you listen to all those records in sequence, they sound a little more samey than I thought at the time. That the difference from record to record, while there is pretty subtle. A lot of the songs I think could be interchangeable from record to record.
But it hurts because they're only two people.
What?
They only had two people, and I think
they only had two people, yeah. But
well, I was one of them.
I mean, it's the limitation. I mean, it's not even the fact they had two people. They really made a conscious effort to almost always only use two instruments, which they broke away from later. But I mean, you know, if you're in a rock band, you're already limited by the fact that it's like six strings and electricity, four strings and electricity, drums, vocals. So if you remove the four strings and electricity, you know, you're really sort of, you know, handcuffing yourself.
But I always thought that degree of difficulty, though, it was almost like the NBA, an NBA team winning 50 games with four guys in the court. It's like, how are they doing this? You know, it's like, you've made it so hard on yourself, and I still enjoy this album. That's kind of amazing.
Well, this is something that you could have, I feel like this could have been in your book. What NBA team could have won the most games using only four players? In the modern era, because in the pre-modern era, like, I mean, that probably, like with Chamberlain, they'd probably do exactly the same.
Yeah.
They'd win the same number of games playing with four guys. But in the modern era, you know, I'm trying to think, it would have to be one of those Bulls teams, because if you put Jordan, Pippen, say Horace Grant, and who'd be the fourth guy you put out there?
I think you need a center if you're going to do this, because then you could basically play a 2-2 zone.
Well, Bill Cartwright, I guess, a healthy Cartwright. That's not a bad form version. You know, the Celtics, I suppose, when it would have been DJ, Mikhail, Bird, and Parrish.
We could have done DJ, Mikhail, Bird, Parrish, and then just counted it inside.
Yeah, that would be the strongest four person. You'd have to obviously allow them to play zone.
Yeah, you'd have to play a 2-2 zone, and you'd have to have a shot blocker. That's why I was thinking, like, maybe the 2001 Lakers. Because Kobe and Shaq, obviously, could handle it offensively, and then you give them Robert Horry and, I don't know, Brian Shaw or somebody to bring the ball up. But that's pretty interesting, though. I like the degree of difficulty. Or, like, what baseball team could have won with eight players?
That would all come down to pitching.
Yes.
I mean, with baseball, it's like, what team could have won the most games with three players?
Yeah.
A pitcher, a catcher, and somebody in the field.
The thing that's changed about me with music the most is that I rarely listen to entire albums anymore, and I just cherry-pick iTunes songs, and I'm ashamed of that. I'm ashamed to admit
that's
that.
That's what's happened to the world. I mean,
I know, but I loved the albums. World. I mean, I was the guy who loved how the songs were selected. I mean, you're the same way, but like, how the songs were selected and the connection between song two and song three and then song four and stuff like that. And now it's like, I mean, I'll still listen to Radiohead from beginning to end.
This is why I said that Chinese Democracy was the last album. And people disagreed with me when I said that, because they're like, well, Lil Wayne sold all these records. Or like, you know, Green Day is making a concept record and Mastodon's making a concept record. But when Lil Wayne sells all these records, it's just because, you know, people are into the idea of him and just sort of want that artifact, the actual content of the record. It could be broken up into singles and people would like it just as much. Mastodon and Green Day, they're consciously doing something no one else is doing. But Chinese Democracy was the only record that came out this decade where the recording process actually began when albums were the only way to put music out. Like, it predates all file sharing. So the mentality that Axl Rose was using on Chinese Democracy was, for a record that came out, you know, last year or whatever, it was still like a 1995 or 1994 worldview. And that's why that, when you play it, it does seem like an old album.
Do you think music is in a better place in 2009 than it was in 2001?
In 2001. 2001 was a particularly strong year for music. But I would say overall, yes. I would say that there's probably more interesting music available now than there was in 2001. However, the experience of enjoying it is totally different. And it's like, you know, if you're the kind of person who likes to sit in your apartment and play an album and sit on the couch and listen to it straight through, sort of appreciate the craftsmanship and like the sequencing, it's probably not as good. It's definitely not as good. So I think there's probably more interesting bands now because it's easier for small bands to exist with the record industry no longer there.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I do think it's a shame that the album has gone by the wayside. And, you know, even like when you go to clubs now, and the clubs now won't even play an entire song. Two minutes of a song, it merges to another song. Like, people don't even have the attention span to hear a song now.
Oh, I mean, yeah, you started noticing that when the only thing people were interested in, this is like at the beginning of the decade again, with mashups. And it was sort of like, you can no longer sort of blow my mind with a White Stripes song, it's got to be a White Stripes song with an AC/DC song, and you've got to match them up perfectly.
And now it's just one ongoing song that merges. What's up? Merges to another song, merges to another song, merges to another, and it just goes. And it goes for 6 hours.
Now, here's the sports thing I want to talk to you
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
I want to get to this. Okay. And I hope you haven't talked about this in other podcasts. But
okay.
So the Colts are undefeated, and the Saints are undefeated. And the Saints basically come out and say, we sort of owe it to our fans and to our players to go for this. This is a meaningful thing. We just got to do it. The Colts, of course, have done the exact opposite. They're like, we don't care at all. We're not even going to play Manning. Now they're sort of backing off that and saying they're going to try to win these games. But I feel like this is a situation where a kind of a quandary that existed forever is going to be solved. Which of these philosophies do you think is better to use? Because I really feel like I kind of agree with Sean Payton. I guess I totally do. I feel like you sort of owe it to both the players and the people who care about your team to attempt to go undefeated, if that's possible.
Well, you're asking the wrong guy.
because of the Patriot situation, but that should give you better insight.
I know. And my answer would be rest the guys and try to win the Super Bowl. Because basically what, you know, the Patriots went 16-0, and then they won the next two games, and then they lost the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care that they went 16-0 anymore. Like, they have the banner in Gillette Stadium or whatever it's called, and all it does is remind me of the fact that we lost the Super Bowl. So I guess the whole point and why I was
But tell me this. If the Patriots had gone 14-2 and won the Super Bowl, you'd probably remember them as the best of those Patriots teams. But their whole kind of era of teams. But it would also seem not unlike their other victories. I feel like if David Tyree doesn't make that catch and the Patriots win the Super Bowl and they go 17-0, to me that accomplishment would be greater than two Super Bowls.
Here's the issue,
maybe greater than three. I guess if I was Michael Irvin, I totally understand what Michael Irvin is talking about, and I think that, you know, when he says, like, he'd trade all his Super Bowl rings and the Hall of Fame to go undefeated, I think that was one thing, actually, that was very well illustrated in that 30 for 30 about Miami, about the U, in that if you have the mentality that you want to step on everyone's throats and dominate everyone in totality, the only way you can do that is to go undefeated. So I would have to try that.
I'm with you, and it makes sense on paper, and you're right. It's a higher degree of difficulty, and it takes more effort, talent, everything. But here's the problem. The NFL, it's just too hard to be that much better than everybody week after week. And I think the pressure as it builds and the media and all the stuff, like, it wore that Patriots team down. The best thing that would have happened to them is if they had lost the Baltimore game, which they should have lost on Monday night, and they got bailed out on a fourth down.
In the same way the Saints should have lost to Washington. What also is sort of the interesting X factor, that if the Colts, say the Colts rest everybody, and they still win those three games, that would give them such an overwhelming psychological edge going into the playoffs if they were somehow to manage to go 3-0 with sort of like lesser talent. Here's the other thing I'm thinking about.
Wait, hold on. I have one more thought.
Okay.
I do think the only way this can happen is the scenario that we have right now, because you have two teams going for it, which means that the attention is split up, and that's more of a story than actually the two teams. But if the Colts lose on Thursday night, now all that attention goes to the Saints, and I watched it wear down the Patriots. By the Super Bowl, they were just grim. They wanted to get that game over with, and they were overconfident, and it screwed them up. I'm convinced.
Their regular season game against the Giants, I felt that last game of the year, that was very – the fatigue of that was clear on them.
You could see it.
The other thing, this is definitely a kind of a – I realize this is not probable, but, you know – the Patriots went undefeated during the regular season, and now we've got two teams who seem like they're on the cusp of it. What if now going undefeated was like the 4-minute mile in Roger Bannister? What if all of a sudden this starts happening, not all the time, but consistently? Could there have been an intellectual change among teams now after seeing the Patriots, that the idea once you get 9-0 or 10-0, that it's not impossible to win the rest of those games? Could this start becoming something that happens every third year, every fourth year, that a team is undefeated down to the very end of the year?
But couldn't you argue that that's already happening, though?
Well, see, the Bears were 11-0 when they got beaten by Miami.
Because the Colts, you forget this now, but the Colts in 05 or 06, yep, they started out, this is the first time it became a really big deal.
They were 12-0, right? And they got beat by San Diego. Am I imagining this? Or?
I can't remember. That all blends together.
I feel like they got about this far then. The year the Vikings went 15-1, I think they had lost the second game of the year or something. So the idea of going undefeated was never really in the equation. It doesn't happen that often.
The bigger problem, though, is that every game that the team plays ends up being the Super Bowl. Like, you saw that last week in that Washington game. Washington's out of the playoffs. That's the biggest game they have all year. And not just that, but they're trying to end this streak. It gives them a motivation that totally supersedes whatever their actual talents are.
That's why college football's better, because that happens every week to somebody. Every week somebody's playing Florida or Texas or USC or something, and it's that exact scenario.
College football's better. Come on.
It is.
It's better maybe to attend as a fan.
No, it's better to watch.
The quality is not better. Yeah, because it's more random. It's like watching a roulette wheel.
No, it's not.
It's random.
It's not random. If it was random, Texas wouldn't be playing for the national championship.
Oh, I watched that game. That clock should have counted out.
It was a strange scenario where if Sue doesn't rush McCoy, the clock runs out.
How do you feel about the fundamental problem in college of you have guys who aren't quite ready for the situation they're in over and over again deciding these games? It kind of makes you feel bad constantly.
I think that's what makes it interesting. I think it's exciting that very often I'm watching a MAC game on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, and the quarterback goes down and his backup comes in, and it's one of the rare times a school like, say, Kent State or Toledo or something is on national television, and I know I'm watching the biggest moment in that person's life forever. There will never be a moment for the rest of his existence that is as high profile and as meaningful as this. And you're seeing it happen, and it happens all the time. Because he's not going to the NFL. He's going to become, a Phi-Ed teacher or a banker or something, So you're really seeing someone at the apex of their existence. And that very rarely happens in the NFL.
I like that angle. My two issues with college football, other than the fact that I didn't go to a college that had a huge team, the fact that coaches can just switch schools and bone over everybody they recruited and those guys had to stay there is just awful.
Makes it very clear who to root for and who not to root for.
It's just horrible.
It's very obvious to me which people are the good people and which are the bad people. I don't mind dudes acting like bad people in public when they're sports figures, because that sort of indicates to me how I should feel about them. Most of the time, as with Tiger Woods, we didn't know for years. But when Nick Saban leaves a bunch of kids in the lurch, you understand that that's the kind of person he is.
But it seems like most of the coaches are of that caliber.
There's nobody. If you had to look for a profession with the worst people in America,
number one coaching, college coaching,
football coaches in general.
Yeah,
college coaches especially, because right now in college basketball, it's kind of hard to find a good guy. Really, I mean, there's some, but there's not.
College basketball, I would put slightly above college football for how scummy the coaches are. Like Calipari. How does Calipari even have a job right now? How many places can he leave in the lurch?
He always gets off somehow. He's like, it's out, like he, in, at least in that regard, he knows what he's doing. How much have you seen John Wall play this year?
I have a passionate, passionate man crush on him. Since Kevin Durant have I been this excited. I was just talking to somebody about how unbelievable, first of all, he's obviously the number one pick. There's no question. But there's a variety of teams that could get that number one pick where it would be really messed up. Like, for instance, Utah has the New York Knicks pick. If they got John Wall if they got the first pick, they would have to trade Darren Williams. John Wall is going to be better than Darren Williams. They would be insane to try to play them both.
You're really tough on Darren Williams. I've never understood why you're so tough on him.
He's a fine player.
You always compare him to Chris Paul, and I never know why. I mean, just because they happen to be the same age and play the same position, he's a pretty good player.
He's a very good player. John Wall is on potentially the Dwayne Wade and above level.
I mean, it's very early now. He's definitely a great-looking guy. He's a great-looking player. It's too bad that, this one-and-done thing is a problem. I really wish it was 2 years.
Terrible.
It would be better for the game, better for the guys, better in every way.
Awful.
Yeah. Well, it's awful.
I think college sports in general is awful, and I think we're all enablers. We're like IMG with Tiger. Like, college sports is awful. It's, these guys make no money. John Wall is like, hey, we got John Wall. Yeah, you got him for 8 months, and then he leaves. Like, so he's not a student athlete.
So you're arguing your reason for not liking sports is the ethical hypocrisy.
I just think college sports has so many issues with it. The BCS is just indefensible. The fact that John Wall can show up on the Kentucky campus on August 28th and leave on April 3rd and not even finish his classes, you know, and then just start working out for the combines, and this, and we're pretending this is college sports. It's a joke.
But what are we pretending? I mean, do you
What are we pretending? That's my whole point.
Exactly. I'm not pretending anything.
Just pay the players.
When I watch John Wall play, I'm not sort of thinking to myself, you know, I really like him, and I'm really happy he's getting an A in sociology. I mean, I don't think people look like that. It's just that, you know, these colleges have become these, you know, these institutions that offer many things. They offer education to people who want an education, and they offer sports entertainment for people who are interested in sports entertainment, and it's a way to raise revenue so that they can give scholarships to some kid who's just a really good leader and does very well in civics, and maybe he gets high on the SAT, so now he can go to Tennessee or Kentucky or whatever. So I look at college sports, it doesn't really bother me. I mean, sure, I like it when Stanford does well, and when, you know, Toby Gerhardt's got like a 3.3 GPA or whatever on this very difficult double major, that makes me like him more. It makes me maybe root for Stanford slightly more, but that's not why I'm watching it. I'm not watching it because I have a vested interest in the meaning of...
But the whole point is, competitively, schools that are willing to either bend the rules or take somebody that is only going to be there for 8 months or, you know, recruit a certain type of guy. Like, Charlie Weiss gets fired from Notre Dame, and I'm not saying he was a good coach or a bad coach. He probably was a bad one, but he had specific types of players that he was allowed to recruit, and that's it. And he's playing against other schools that don't have those same things. It just seems weird. It seems wrong to me.
So when you're watching, say, Notre Dame play against a school who doesn't have those limitations,
let's say Florida.
Okay, exactly. Okay. I don't know what the situation like Florida is now, but I would agree with you. Okay. So you're watching Notre Dame play Florida. One school basically is limiting the kind of kids that they recruit, and they're limiting to can they perform at the academic level as most of the other students. The other school is only looking for athletes. Okay, doesn't that add one more layer of interest to the game to you? To me, that's a much better reason for rooting for Notre Dame than your reason for rooting for the Patriots to beat the Jets. The Patriots are just a bunch of guys who aren't from New England, who are there now, pay taxes there now, and have been adopted by your city. That's
you're a sports atheist, though. Of course you're going to say that.
Well.
Yeah, I think I have totally legitimate reasons. First of all, why aren't all the schools that cheat? Why can't we put them all in the same conference? Have it called the cheating conference, whatever. Like, why does John Calipari get to be in the same conference with guys who are actually doing things the right way and don't have World Wide West funneling players to them?
Because, like, why is the world unfair? How come people who cheat on their taxes and people who don't pay or who do pay their taxes, why for the most part are they in the same world? Why do some people succeed by not working and some people work very hard and still fail? I mean, that's a reflection of reality.
That wasn't your best counterargument.
What do you mean?
Your better counterargument would have been, well, why do you watch baseball? Because I would have had no response.
Well, baseball gets dull.
I mean, the baseball, like where the Yankees and Red Sox and three other teams can just outspend it.
That's a great reason to root for teams like the Twins and stuff. I mean, it's really interesting that the Twins are competitive considering they have or any team like that, you know.
I think the best argument for college football is the fact that it is 10 times more exciting to go to any college football game than any NFL game. NFL games are mostly awful to go to. And college football, you'd be really hard-pressed to go to a college football game and not be at least excited to be in the crowd. If it's
live sporting events are not fun. I like televised sporting events.
I'd like televised sporting events.
Much more than live events. Much more.
But I think college football is the one sport where it's still really fun to go to a college football game.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
For people who like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, in New York, you don't really have the option. What college football game could you go to?
The college football team here, I guess when Rutgers is good, people care about Rutgers. But really, Penn State is sort of the home team here, it seems like. I mean, when I read the Times college, you know, the sports section on Sunday, it seems like a Penn State game probably usually gets the best play.
Well, you're not talking me into college football. So.
But you don't even watch it, right? I mean, even though.
No, I do. I've watched, like, I'm proud of myself. I've watched like 12 or I even watched the Army Navy game. I've watched like probably 14.
Oh, the Army Navy game was a fun game to watch.
Yeah. I like the Army Navy game.
So much more interesting. It's so much. I mean, there's such a sameness to NFL. I mean, I love NFL football, obviously. But I mean, it's just, if I had to give up the ability to watch football on Sunday or the ability to give up watching football on Saturday, it's a very easy choice for me.
But I've told you my whole thing. Like, I like watching the best at anything. And this is why I like watching the Olympics. This is why I watch the Premier League over the MLS. This is why I watch NFL over college football. I like seeing the best at whatever they're doing. That's what I enjoy.
Well, I mean, that's actually not a terrible argument.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the backhanded compliment. I mean, I was watching that Nebraska-Texas game, and my reaction the whole time was, these guys are awful. I thought Colt McCoy was supposed to be good. What's going on with him? Like, it was just, it seemed like two teams that couldn't get out of each other's way for the most part for four quarters. And then somebody kicked the game-winning field goal and everybody's...
Well, and, you know, I guess I shouldn't say the NFL is not entertaining. An interesting thing has really happened, though. They've changed, you know, like all those rule changes they've made over time, the pass-blocking rules, the interference rules, they've now created this huge chasm where basically there's four or five quarterbacks who are unstoppable, and then there are four or five quarterbacks at the bottom of the league who seemingly can't complete a downfield pass.
Right.
And I don't know how they could possibly remedy this problem. I mean, when you watch, like, Manning, Brady, Drew Brees, Kurt Warner when he's playing well, it almost seems unfair that the rules are so slanted toward the offense when those are the guys throwing the ball. But then I'll watch, like, even some mid-level quarterback like Jason Campbell or something.
Yeah.
And it will just seem like, it seems unfair again. You know?
You left out the Bill Polian rule, which was that after the Pats throttled the Colts in the, I forget it was the AFC Championship game around two in Foxborough, the 20-3 game, and the Colts complained that the Pats were too physical and they were knocking their receivers. And so they relaxed all those rules, and now you can't really do anything to receivers at the line. So it's become between not being able to hit the quarterbacks the same way, not being able to punish the receivers going over the middle, and then the amount of leeway the receivers get anyway. You're right. It's like we're creating these super offenses, basically. It's kind of amazing. Like, you look at the 99 Rams that didn't have any of these rules and put up, you know, I don't know if it was more points or as close or something, but now when you think of the rules that they could have had, they had 2009 rules in 1999, holy man, it would have been 70 points a game.
Yeah, well, you know, I really think all of these changes, they still principally go back to letting the offensive linemen extend their arms when they're pass blocking and the 5-yard chuck rule. I think it took probably 15 years for coaches at the collegiate and particularly the high school level to sort of think, you know, passing is a better philosophy than running. And now you're seeing sort of the manifestation of that, of these guys who really were, basically came up as youth football players in the 80s, used to the idea. Because, you know, when you're, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, if you were in a junior high football team or a Pop Warner football team, you just didn't pass. Passing was something you only did in a desperation situation unless you had, you know, this, even if you had an outstanding quarterback, coaches didn't think a little kid could run outfield and catch a ball 18 yards downfield. And now when you watch a high school game, I mean, I don't know, do you ever watch those ESPNU high school games?
Not only have I watched those, but the LA football is surprisingly good. So is the LA basketball.
Great.
They have those on here, and I always
enjoy California and Florida games are great.
Yeah.
And you really see how the philosophy of things have changed. I mean, it's weird that high school teams pretty much now never had the quarterback under center. Ever. Ever. That's actually true. Why would you? What is the benefit? But nobody thought that way for 50 years or 60 years. You know?
Yeah. It's definitely changing. And I don't know where it's going, because eventually when all this concussion stuff shakes out and they really determine like how much damage is going to happen and all that stuff, like I don't know what happens to football.
Well, where it was going, the sad thing that happened is when the Patriots were stopped on 4th-and-2 against the Colts. Because if they succeed there, you would have seen the widespread adoption of, there's this high school coach in Arkansas who never punts.
I read about that guy.
And he's a mathematician, essentially. And mathematically, he has come to pretty rock solid conclusion that what you gain from punting is not what you could gain from getting a first down. And I think if the Patriots succeed there, then Belichick, instead of all of these guys throwing, you know, garbage cans at him or whatever, the idea is, see, he really is a genius. And that would become sort of the normative way to play. And how much more entertaining would football be if teams almost always went for it on fourth down? It would improve the games immensely.
Well, we have 20 solid years of video game evidence that proves that it was much more
exactly,
fun.
Exactly, yeah. All of directions that football have gone were sort of – its origin seemed to be the way kids played video games in the 80s and 90s. You used a shotgun every play. You never punted. If you have one guy who's hot, you go to him over and over and over again, you know.
All right, we got to wrap it up. Eating the Dinosaur, available in bookstores everywhere, and a nice little Christmas gift. Not heavy like my book. Just kind of slide. You can almost slide into the stocking. My book, it's like...
Yeah, mine does not stop bullets.
My book is like a pain in the butt.
My book would not stop a crossbow.
My book is like a pain in the butt to carry to a Christmas party. Your book, you just slide right in the stocking. Please come on next month.
Okay.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Target the sound off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important news, which frankly cannot go unstated. Whether tailgating, watching the game with friends, or just really hungry, attack your hunger with Subway Catering. Pile high platters starting at $25, giant subs, cookies, drinks, and more. So find a reason to party, put Subway Catering in charge, and get busy feasting. Subway. Cater fresh.